monitors are moderate in all things. Health is life. Excess is death. The monitors are helpful. Happiness comes from helping others.
They're loved by young and old.
Hooray.
They do it the common cause.
Oh boy.
We hope they always stay.
Bravo.
And that is why we pray. Dear God, bless each one of them. The monitors.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The BBC World Service asks, who's pushing conspiracy theories? What a cheek. Maybe they are. Last weekend, BBC World Service trending programme asked, who's pushing the Syria conspiracies, taking a close look at two people critical of London media's interpretation of the alleged Douma chemical weapons attack? They were Sarah Abdullah and Vanessa Bealey. Tonight, we ask, are the conspiracy theories coming from them or from private think tanks like Chatham House, which the BBC report uncritically? Also, the Zadists taking on everything President Macron stands for. 7,000 joined squatters near Nantes in western France to defend their buildings from 2,500 riot police and bailiffs. At ZAD, the defence zone, they call it, police have given them until 14th of May to get out. How long can they last? And MI5 at the BBC, does it matter that MI5 worked to prevent a socialist government? By going through the personnel files and making sure no left-wing journalists got promoted. And the mysterious contract killing of Russian journalist Anna Politkovskaya. The London media started saying that Putin killed her without presenting any evidence. Yes, she was writing articles critical of him when she was shot dead in her tower block lift in October 2006. But she was writing articles critical of a lot of people, including the Chechen mafia. So what do we know about who killed her and why? But we begin with the story about the BBC and their programme trending. Now, Martin Summers, the BBC really looking at what is effectively a kind of Twitter tag about the Douma attacks, and saying that there were actually a couple of Twitter accounts, a couple of individuals running them, that were getting far more followers than any of the BBC journalists were, and that this was, they were peddling conspiracy theories.
Well, I mean, everybody accuses people they don't like of being conspiracy theorists and therefore of getting it wrong. And, you know, we've got everybody throwing mud around here. Obviously, the average person, if they're not really following it closely, will find it difficult to work out who is actually telling the truth. But I think the idea that the mainstream media always get it right, and that the critical voices of independent journalists are always wrong, is frankly idiotic. The real problems that we face in Syria are a huge kind of lack of knowledge about what's actually going on in the general population, and, you know, psychological warfare games being played by NATO intelligence services to deliberately muddy the waters. And they openly boast that that's what they do. The White Helmets, for example, are definitely funded by Britain and other Western powers. There's no doubt about that. Nobody disputes it. They were set up as an organisation by James Lemessurier, who's a former British Army officer based in Turkey. And the idea that they are somehow independent a non-governmental organisation is frankly laughable. And it looks pretty clear that they staged the event in Douma. That's what the people that were taken by the Russians to The Hague to testify yesterday said. And they were, you know, people from the hospital where the incident was supposed to have occurred. Nevertheless, the damage is done. The average population believe the government's story because they haven't got time to look into any further details. And, you know, if you've got the weight of the government of the country saying this is what happened, then people, unfortunately, tend to go along with what is actually extremely dubious information. And the consequences of this could be absolutely catastrophic. I mean, we're very lucky that this didn't lead to a conventional weapon exchange between NATO forces and Russian forces. It didn't happen because the Russians showed restraint. But there's no particular reason why they should show restraint. Under international law, when those missiles came in over the Syrian border, and for example, from Akrotiri in Cyprus, under international law, it would be absolutely legitimate for both the Syrian and Russian forces to attack Akrotiri and to go and try and kill British personnel who are responsible for attacking them. That's what international law says. And the West pretensions that they're obeying international law by engaging in these adventures is patently wrong. There is no international law basis for what they've done. Now, what they might argue is, oh, well, there's a higher law, the moral law. But in that case, we've ripped up international law. And of course, in that case, the Russians and the Syrians have got every right to fire back because there is no international law. Under international law, existing international law, we've got the right to fire back. And of course, what they did do is shoot down as many of the incoming missiles as they could. But of course, there either is international law, and under international law they are allowed to fire back. They chose not to because they're showing restraint. Or there is no international law, in which case they've got every right to fire back because there's no rules anyway. And of course, if there is a no-rules fight in the Eastern Mediterranean, the Russian military will win. NATO's whole fleet-based armed forces are obsolete. The Russians have rendered them obsolete. So that's the situation that we're in. We're very lucky that we didn't have a worse situation last week than the one that's transpired. But of course, it's extremely tense and very dangerous.
Okay, so let's have a listen now to the first part of a few clips I've got from this BBC World Service trending programme about the White Helmets. So let's have a listen to that one now.
As we're recording this, chemical weapons inspectors are trying to get into Douma. But Mike Wendling has been looking into the conflicts from a different perspective. You've been looking at the information and misinformation that's been flowing back and forth online.
That's right, Jonathan. And let me just point out right away that just like on the ground in Syria, the online propaganda conflict has numerous actors. It's highly confusing, it's highly complex, it's extremely hard to tell what's real and what's not. However, we've been zooming in on one particular group of activists. Despite all the uncertainty, despite the investigation you just mentioned now, these people are certain that what they believe is the truth.
And you've been spending a little bit of time digging into this, haven't you? And sort of outlining the key characters online. Who are they?
Yes, quite a bit of time, actually. And to tell you this story, I'm going to talk you through just one Twitter account.
Okay.
Although one that's actually one of the most influential when it comes to part of the Syrian conflict online. Let me show you this picture.
Okay, so what I'm seeing is a young woman wearing a bright red dress. It looks like a typical kind of holiday picture, like if you get on Instagram, loads of people upload this kind of picture.
Yeah,
all the time.
Quite a
selfie,
a stylish shot.
Yeah,
she's sitting on some steps.
Sure,
floral print dress. And this particular account, her name, by the way, is Sarah Abdallah. This particular account posts many of these pictures, just Sarah by herself. Sometimes maybe a view of nature, like something out of a window, a forest, but not much else. So, like you say, it seems pretty normal what people post on social media all the time. But then there's the actual tweets, the actual messages this account sends out. They're tweets like these.
The history of Syrian false flags exposed. Reports of chemical weapons attack in rebel-held town of Douma are fabricated. The goal of such reports is to aid terrorists.
And all of this has got her a huge following on Twitter. More than 125,000 followers, to be exact.
That's huge. I mean, that's more than a lot of journalists get.
Yeah, that's a good point. More than a lot of journalists, a lot of top journalists, including some who have been covering the Middle East for years, including some of our colleagues here at the BBC.
Well, there's a compliment. More people following Sarah Abdullah than these BBC correspondents. And I'm joined on the line now from France by Vanessa Bealey, who's another one of the people who have been called. I guess it, Vanessa, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Okay. Have you actually been called a Twitter troll? Am I right?
Actually, Tony, thanks for having me on. I've kind of lost track of the insults that have been flung in my direction by a series of mainstream media outlets, including the BBC. But yes, I'm quite sure that in among some of the monikers they've given me, there is Russian troll, yes.
What do you make of this Sarah Abdullah account then? This is someone that they say has been peddling massive amounts of disinformation and eclipsing the BBC's own journalists on Twitter.
Well, I suggest that's a reflection on public consensus regarding the BBC journalists. I mean, regardless of who Sarah Abdullah or even regardless of who I am, the very fact that a Twitter commentator, I mean, Sarah, as far as I know, is exclusively on Twitter, whereas, of course, I've just returned from 5 weeks inside Syria, most of it spent in eastern Ghouta, Damascus and Douma. If a Twitter commentator such as Sarah Abdullah is eclipsing the BBC coverage, particularly of the Syrian conflict, then I would be extremely concerned at the BBC. And rather than attacking the Twitter commentator, I would be looking very closely at why public consensus is turning against the BBC.
Well, in that same programme broadcast by the World Service twice last weekend, they also mentioned you, Vanessa. So let's have a listen to that clip now.
The top influencers in this anti-white helmets network call themselves anti-war, but at the same time, they're calling for the bombing of emergency services. John Kelly mentioned another influential account in there, that of Vanessa Bealey. Now, we know a bit more about Bealey than we do about Sarah Abdullah. She describes herself as an independent journalist, and she has more than 30,000 Twitter followers. We asked her for an interview. We sent her a list of questions. In response, she called our story a, quote, blatant attempt to silence independent journalism. But John Kelly says that what she's doing is not journalism at all.
We've looked at dozens of these disinformation campaigns. What we found in the Syria case was a pattern of online behavior which was very close to things we've seen before. In fact, when you're looking at these disinformation campaigns, a lot of the same characters show up for every party, you know, which is one of the ways that you can tell that it's a disinformation campaign as opposed to an organic groundswell or kind of organic emergent conversation about something.
Cue the spooky music. Anyway, Vanessa, is that true what they say? Did they ask you for an interview? Did they send you questions? Because you didn't appear on their piece.
I'm assuming this is related to Mike Wendling of BBC Trending, correct?
That's right, that's the programme, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he contacted me the first time a few months ago when The Guardian ran the initial sort of smear piece into anybody that was exposing the White Helmets, but predominantly myself, Eva Bartlett, Tim Anderson and 21st Century Wire. Then I'm just having a quick look back through my emails. He then contacted me on April the 16th, so when I was actually inside Syria. I told him to send me over. He didn't make any indication or give me any indication that he was going to have me on the BBC. He simply said that he was writing an article and he wanted me to respond. So he then sent over a series of questions which frankly were like a police inspector's report, asking me to justify various evidences that I'd put forward. For example, would I describe myself as an independent journalist? have I or 21st Century Y received funding for your work from the Syrian government or its allies? Extraordinary question.
Isn't it simple for you to just answer that one? I mean, have you?
Yeah, of course I have. I responded to Wendling, I will tell you exactly when, on April the 17th, so one day after he had sent the question through, and I responded to his email in full. My response on the funding is quite simply, if he's going to pursue the line that I am being funded by the Syrian government or by the Russian government or by any of these entities or affiliated entities, he would be entering the territory of slander. So I think that was a pretty clear response on my part. But yes, I answered every single question that he sent me.
And I suppose, you know, you could say he's funded by the British government and the White Helmets are funded by the British government.
Pretty much every actor inside Syria that is destabilising Syria has some degree of financing from the British government, either directly or covertly, via a number of intermediaries that act as plausible deniability when the assets on the ground are caught committing crimes against the Syrian people, yes.
What do you make of what the upshot has been of this? Apparently, half of the world is being told by its media that the Douma attack was a genuine attack by the Assad government. Oh, actually, they usually use the word regime because they don't like them, usually calling a regime if they don't like the government. And the other half of the world is being told that actually it's fake and that the idea was just to create an excuse for a missile strike. So where do you stand on this and how do we make sense of it?
Well, I mean, I think what is extraordinary, and I think people are losing that in the conflicting information war that is obviously happening, but that's, you know, that is to be expected. I mean, if you have a car crash, you will have two conflicting reports on that car crash to the insurance company. To expect only 10 days after the event actually happened, more than that, for there to be any level-headed conclusion as to who was behind this attack, who, whether it was true or not, is insane. To carry out a tripartite unlawful act of aggression using more than 100 Tomahawk-type missiles against a sovereign nation with no substantiation except for alleged offences is probably, I mean, this has to warrant the title of a supreme war crime. And yet that is now getting buried in the conflict between those who are saying there was no chemical weapon attack, as you quite rightly point out, and those who are saying there was. Now, I went into Douma 3 days ago, in fact, just before I left Syria, and I spoke to doctors, to medical staff inside the medical point where the victims of that night's attack, now I put attack in inverted commas because the majority of those doctors and medical staff told me there was an attack because this was an ongoing military campaign to liberate Douma from Jaish al-Islam, a Saudi financed terrorist group, and there was an attack. People were emerging from the tunnels and from the basements of their houses with smoke inhalation and dust inhalation, and that was what was bringing them into the hospital. What then happened, the White Helmets and a number of other actors on the ground entered the hospital crying chemical weapon attack. They then doused the children who had been affected by the smoke inhalation with water, and remember that there is an 11-year-old boy, Hassan Diab, who's giving evidence today in The Hague with OPCW, explaining that entire event. But, you know, this wasn't only confirmed by doctors and medical staff. We walked around Douma about 700 metres, in an area 700 metres away from where the attack allegedly took place. And everybody that we spoke to really just laughed when we said, was there a chemical weapon attack? They said, of course not. You know, we wouldn't be here right now if there had been. We wouldn't be here and life wouldn't be continuing as normal. There was nothing, no chemical weapon attack on that night. So, you know, from my perspective, the fact that we attacked Syria, we being the US, France, and the UK with Israel in a surveillance role. It's quite incredible, and this is setting a precedent. I mean, we've now attacked a sovereign nation based on zero evidence, not even a dodgy dossier.
We'll have a listen now to the final clip from the BBC's trending programme last weekend, which makes an attempt to find somebody independent to make some sort of give us some advice and commentary and narrative on the power of social media, because clearly people like you, Vanessa, and Sarah Abdullah seem to be worrying people at the BBC that people are more interested in getting their news from social media than they are from them. So let's have a listen to this final clip now.
To try and make sense of this, I went to an objective source on social media in Syria. I spoke to Scott Lucas. He's a professor of international politics at the University of Birmingham here in the UK. He's the editor of a news and analysis site called EA Worldview.
If they had simply been an individual account on Twitter that is just blaring out Assad good, opposition bad, Syrian army good, white helmets rescuers bad, if it was just a single account on social media, well, now you just say, okay, that's just part of the chatter, that's part of the white noise that you put up on a day-to-day basis. But the ability of social media, of course, is for these folks to connect and to magnify their individual voices by getting people to retweet what they put out, even if it has no basis in fact, even if it is in fact flagrant agitation or disinformation. And if you get a dozen and then dozens and then hundreds of people to spread your unfounded assertions, then you start to have influence. And then if you get someone like an organized entity like the Russian state that takes notice of you, that actually likes what you're doing, then you make this leap into supposedly becoming, quote, a journalist.
So there he is, Scott Lucas from the University of Birmingham. He apparently is... I was expecting to hear a British voice, but no, it is an American. Martin Summers, what do you make of his commentary there on what's happening with social media? He's effectively saying that social media has enabled an entire group of people to get together and counter what the government is telling us is true.
Well, that's right, and that's what they don't like about it. The question is what they're saying true or false, which, of course, he doesn't bother to engage in. He's just basically trying to say that, professional journalists and academics decide what truth is, and everybody else has just got to suck it up. But he doesn't actually enter into any discussion of what's true and false in the situation at all. And they don't really want to enter into a discussion about that, because in actual fact, all the evidence is against them. And of course, the psychological warfare operations in which NATO engages. We do. It's a fact that British Army has Brigade 77, which has 1,000 members, all of whom are officers, and they spend all day, every day, on social media pretending to be people other than they are in order to try and sway public opinion. That's a fact.
Vanessa, are you clear that you did everything you could to actually have your voice heard on this World Service programme? Because obviously the World Service has got a tremendous reach.
I responded to the questions. I mean, I wasn't aware that I could do any more than that. I responded very honestly and very openly to the question. Out of my response, they took about two sentences. I'd also quite quickly like to say, I mean, Professor Lucas is wheeled out as a so-called neutral commentator on particularly the White Helmets, but on Syria in general. However, he has very strong links to Mayday Rescue, to Dima Muta, who is a member of Mayday Rescue. Mayday Rescue is the intermediary that was set up by James Lemessurier, the creator of the White Helmets. He created the White Helmets in March 2013. 1 year later, he set up Mayday Rescue to basically funnel British government funds into the White Helmets. Now, Scott Lucas has very clear connections to that organization. He has a number of other very clear connections to think tanks and to organizations that are supporting, or at least to a degree whitewashing, some of the terrorist groups such as Araw Sham on the ground inside Syria. And he has cited Mustafa al-Hajj Yusuf, the White Helmet leader in Khan Shihun, who has himself himself called for the unity of ISIS, Nusra Front, and a number of other terrorist groups. He's called for the shelling of civilians in Damascus in 2014, and he has endorsed the killing of prisoners of war and the execution of prisoners of war and theft from civilian homes. So this is just one of the so-called reliable witnesses that Lucas is relying upon. I recently did a debate with Lucas on Al-Mayadeen. At the end of this debate, which involved four people, including Lucas, myself, a representative from the Russian UN mission in Geneva, and a professor from Egypt based in Washington, Lucas's only response was to call myself and the Russian representative from the UN mission liars. So as your other guest, as Martin Simmons, has just said, he does not ever address the evidence, neither does the BBC, neither do any of these mainstream outlets who have conducted the smear campaign. They simply conduct ad hominem attacks to try and discredit the activists, the journalists, the reporters, the Twitter personalities who are pushing back against the mainstream narrative on Syria, but they never address the facts or the evidence.
So when the BBC announced Scott Lucas as an objective person, they're lying.
Categorically.
They also said about you and Sarah Abdullah that you are calling for the bombing of the emergency services in Syria.
That is complete nonsense. I mean, what both of us have made very clear is that the White Helmet cannot be described as a humanitarian organisation. All of the evidence from inside Syria points to the fact that they work extremely closely and collaborate with Nusra Front, which is al-Qaeda inside Syria. Civilian testimony from inside Syria has stated that they have participated in torture, in executions, in mopping up after Nusra Front executions. And we've seen members of this organization filming themselves, by the way, climbing over the dismembered corpses of prisoners of war and enjoying the parading of a severed head during that murder of Syrian Arab Army soldiers. And there are a number of videos showing the White Helmets participating in the brutality of the various terrorist organizations, including in East Aleppo, where their center was only 200 meters from Al-Mashhad Square, where Abdullah Aida, the 12-year-old Palestinian child, was beheaded by Nur al-Din Zinki. So this group clearly was embedded and is embedded with terrorist groups in Syria that are committing atrocities against the Syrian people, and as such, they do not qualify for the international ruling regarding protection of humanitarian organisations inside Syria.
No, they very don't. Clear. They certainly don't. And also, there are special forces from the United States. We know at least two bases in Syria now, and British special forces.
There's more than 20. US bases or UK bases? Sorry.
I was thinking US, US, and there's UK and French special forces in Syria. Yeah. This conflict, are we going to see, do you think, it develop more into open confrontation between the Russians and the NATO countries?
Well, I think there was a very interesting statement from the Russian representative, and I can't remember his name, but at the OPCW. And he said that we have to be prepared for further false flag events to try and escalate the military conflict between Russia and the US coalition on Syrian soil. I mean, this was very clearly what the Douma incident was about. And actually, what was interesting, I was in Damascus when the Tripartite Alliance bombed Syria, and Russia didn't fire one air defense missile in anger. It was entirely left to Syria to defend itself, and it did a very good job of it. And what is also interesting, Tony, is that the OPCW has put out a statement saying that the Baze, so-called chemical weapon manufacturing plant that was targeted by that missile attack, did not have on site any chemicals. So again, that has demonstrated that the reasoning for this attack was entirely false. Not only had the Douma chemical weapon attack not even, you know, hardly dried on the paper and certainly not been investigated, but the claim that the Jamaya and the Baze chemical, the technological labs and manufacturing sites were making chemical weapons is also proven to be false.
I mean, isn't there an even bigger journalistic failure in the failure of the Western press to even question the wisdom of bombing a chemical weapons plant?
Yes. I mean, I actually did put out a question on Twitter the other day. To what degree do the mainstream media outlets question how the British government, the US government, EU member states are acting under international law? I mean, you know, if we all took international law as a benchmark for our journalism, it would be very clear right now who is violating that international law and who is adhering to it. And that is surely what journalism has a duty to do, but they're failing to do that.
Well, you sent me also a fascinating clip from the BBC's Hard Talk, where what we had was the Syrian MP, Faraz Shahabi, and he's from Aleppo, talking to Stephen Sacca. So I hope you can stick with us for another minute or so, Vanessa, to have a little listen to an excerpt from the BBC's Hard Talk.
11 million people, at least, from your country, pretty much half your country's population, has had to flee its home. So when you say to me, this isn't about Bashar al-Assad, it's about Syria, the Syrian people defending themselves, half of the Syrian people have been forced to flee their homes. Your country is ruined. This conflict has ruined your country.
Ask the ones who left. Why did they leave? And you will find that more than 90% of them left because they wanted to escape from jihadi terrorism that NATO supports. Please, when you have the Saudis and the Qataris, which are the most backward, radical regimes in the world, pouring money, pouring petrodollars, and bringing 250,000 jihadi mercenaries to our country, this is what's going to happen to us. Exactly. I agree with you. We will have a huge tragedy. We will have big suffering. But at the end, we have to look at the causes. Look, we are saying we are with democratic elections. We want reform. We want drastic reform. We want improvement. We want liberty. We want democracy. But who's going to give us democracy? Jihadi radicalism going to give us democracy?
Mr. Shahabi,
we're not defending Assad. We are defending secular Syria.
All right.
And actually, I mean, I suppose he could have also said what you were saying, defending the rule of law, Vanessa.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what was extraordinary here was the rhetoric that Sacca used. I mean, half of Syrians have left Syria. That's a lie. You know, over 7 million Syrians that are internally displaced, where have they gone? They've gone to Syrian government secure areas. Over 1 million have returned to Aleppo since East Aleppo was liberated from the Western back terrorist occupation. I mean, you know, it's just extraordinary sensationalism that is being deployed by
okay.
the...
Okay, well, finally, Vanessa, I wonder if you could just paint us a picture of what the NATO and Western countries' involvement is in Syria, because we know... I mean, I've spoken to ex-army people who say, oh, well, we were in Syria, but, of course, none of this has been given permission by Parliament, let alone any kind of sign-off by the British press, the British people. These are covert bases. To what extent are there Western troops in there, either training terrorists, training jihadis, or else doing the fighting themselves?
I mean, that's a very difficult question to answer accurately, but in the northeast, for example, we know now that there are probably around 20 US bases, and they're in the process of power multiplying. A very small percentage of Kurdish separatists that are looking for a separate state within Syria. And they're also, we believe, and it has been reported, retraining terrorist factions to join and power multiply the Kurdish factions, and that includes ISIS, by the way. We know from various sort of scattered reports, I mean, I believe there was a British operative killed near Burn Beach, which is in the north west, only about a month ago. And there has been an inquiry, I believe, in Parliament as to how exactly he was killed. So, you know, it's very clear that there are, as you say, covert troops, boots on the ground, special forces on the ground. I have had reports from a number of areas that have been liberated that they've found not only British, but French, German, and US troops among the victims in the military campaigns to liberate specific areas. So it's very clear that Britain has been training groups on the ground and is on the ground inside Syria. I mean, we know now also that obviously France is being used to effectively colonize areas of Syria again on the basis that they're saying they're there to prevent the re-emergence of ISIS. Well, my suggestion would be right now Syria and Russia are liberating the south of Damascus, so the young Palestinian suburb area and around that, from ISIS. So why is this alliance, the US, France and the UK, not collaborating with Syria and with the Russians and its allies in Iran and Hezbollah to defeat ISIS to the south of Damascus? You know, it's sheer hypocrisy, Tony. It's
good question. Finally, can you just, I did say finally before, but can you just give us a few pointers as to good places to go to actually, you know, go round the BBC's, I have to say, appalling programme, trending. I mean, clearly not trending with their journalists because they're just not really being followed by most of the people on social media. They're not, people aren't interested in listening to their lies. Whereabouts can people go other than Twitter? Are there any good news services around the world that we can follow what's happening there on?
I think, I mean, obviously I would put forward 21st Century Wire, UK Column do a very good daily news programme covering events in Syria and elsewhere. The journalists that I would suggest following, because they write from various media outlets, are, for example, Sharmeen Nawani, Eva Bartlett, Professor Tim Anderson. I would follow Professor Piers Robinson, who has set up the Syria Working Group to monitor the propaganda against Syria real-time, which is a very exciting development, actually, within academia, to have academics following and monitoring the level of propaganda that is being deployed against Syria, actually as it's happening, rather than as academics tend to.
And another major journalist is Robert Fisk. He's been reporting very
absolutely
critically and incredible. Here's somebody with more awards, more experience than almost any other British journalist, and he's simply being totally sidelined by all the major networks over here.
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary. You know, Fisk has actually maintained a pretty middle ground line in Syria, but he went to Douma. He was one of the first Muslim journalists to enter. And he reported back what he saw and heard, which is what all honest journalists should be doing. And as you say, he's now being maligned for that because he simply, you know, he stepped out of the frame that most journalists have to work within.
Anyway, Vanessa Beely, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, Martin, what do you make of all of this?
Well, I mean, obviously, I follow Vanessa's work quite closely, and it was great to have her on. I mean, her analysis of what goes on over there is invaluable, and it's first-hand, on-the-ground journalism,
I mean, unlike
pontificating from a cosy study in academia.
Or the BBC World Service. Mm. I mean, it's absolutely appalling that they're putting forward this person who's so biased, Scott Lucas, as someone who's supposed to be objective. I mean, that's just a simple,
he's directly linked to organisations directly linked to the White Helmets.
It's a blatant lie. He's at Birmingham University, which is actually not far from Coventry, is it?
Why are we mentioning Coventry?
Well, because this is where James Le Mesurier is based.
Oh, was it? No, you're thinking of the Syrian Observation of Human Rights. That's the...
No, James Le Mesurier has got his office in Coventry.
Well, I know that the office of the Syrian Observatory of Human Rights, which is what some guy in his bedroom is based in Coventry.
Well,
so I didn't
realize. Maybe he's next door to James Le Mesurier.
Really, it wouldn't be surprising. I understood that Le Mesurier was actually based in Turkey when he set all this stuff up. But in any case, the idea that this is an independent non-governmental organisation in which is massive amounts of government money are channeled to it. I mean, the Swedish Physicians for Human Rights have even suggested they've actually murdered children for their videos. So there you go.
Now, on Dialect, coming up on Wednesday next week at noon, we're hoping very much to be able to bring it to you because there have been all sorts of technical problems the last 6 weeks. The technical team here at BCFM haven't been able to bring you Dialect, but I'm promised that this Wednesday it will be happening. You can get it online at dialectradio.co.uk. Did a fantastic, I thought, fascinating interview with Professor Alexander Azadgan, from California, and here is what he had to say about Qatar, because Vanessa mentioned them just now, maybe it wasn't Vanessa, it was the Syrian MP Fares Shahabi that mentioned them, but let's have a listen to what he had to say about Qatar now, and also some of the bigger geopolitical things that are going on in the Middle East.
We are transitioning from petroleum to natural gas, and Saudi Arabia is in the eighth ranking. The first two are U.S., Russia, followed by Iran and Qatar, or Qatar and Iran. They sort of go back and forth. So they feel an existential threat when it comes to future income, future revenues, cash flow from their Iranian and Qatari counterparts. So we have that element to it. That's why they're threatened by Qatar, and they have their ridiculous 13-item so-called
demands
to the Qataris. The first one is shut down Al Jazeera. I mean, they have no concept of the modern world and how media functions. And I believe second or third, somewhere in the very top, is sever all your relations with Iran. Qataris happen to share the world's largest natural gas field under the Persian Gulf with the Iranians. They're not going to sacrifice or create a bad blood with the Iranians, even though they're part of the GCC and there is bad blood between them, because Qatar supported the terrorists in northern Iraq and Syria. They supported these ISIS monsters. But they're changing. There's a change of policy, massive change of policy going on in Qatar.
I think fascinating, some of this stuff to do with the changing nature, Martin, of energy. But what Alexander Azargan there, I suppose, is pointing out is that there's this whole list of demands that the Qataris are supposed to be obeying at the moment, including closing down Al Jazeera and severing all ties with Iran.
Well, the other thing that the Saudis were suggesting is they've got to send troops to northern Syria. And the Saudis are pushing for an invasion of northern Syria by Gulf Cooperation Council troops. And they want the Qataris to send their they've got about 6,000 soldiers in Qatar. It's only a small state. And, of course, what they really want is for those soldiers to be killed in Syria so that they can then absorb Qatar into Saudi Arabia. But that's where we're going. That's the next thing that's going to happen, is that the democratic states of Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates and Qatar are being bullied into line to invade Syria so that the Americans can go home. It's and almost, Trump can say he's got out of it.
These sorts of demands from one state onto another are almost unprecedented, aren't they? I mean, it does sound incredible. It's a bit like what we heard earlier from the Board of Deputies of British Jews telling the Labour Party, you're going to have an ombudsman. You know, actually, from one organisation saying to another, this is how you run things. This is, we're starting to get into a really quite a hostile area, and there doesn't seem to be any kind of real criticism by the mainstream press saying, well, actually, you can't tell that other country how to behave. You can't tell them what to do. I mean, what I'm suggesting here is, obviously not with the Labour Party and the Board of Deputies, but with Qatar and Saudi Arabia, is this could be a precursor to war.
Well, listen, if you're living in Syria, it already is a war. The idea that this war hasn't started is laughable. It's been going on since 9/11 and the invasion of Iraq, and it was going on before that if you lived in Argentina during the dictatorship. War has been going on for a long time, and we're getting to the point now where it could turn into a worldwide conflagration. The only thing preventing that is the common sense of the Russian political leadership and the professionalism of their military. Because if they were led by other lesser people, we'd already be well into it. But they've actually done everything they can to avoid it.
But this is really self-interest from the Russians. They can't afford to lose Syria and the bases in the Eastern Mediterranean, can they?
No, well, they're not there because of the base at Tartarus. That's absurd. In actual fact, the US has got 130 bases all over the world. The Chinese have got one base outside China, which is in Djibouti, but they've only just opened. The fact of the matter is, the Russians are in Syria because if the Syrian regime had collapsed and a jihadi regime had been set up there, it would have become a base for attacks inside Russia to destabilize the Chinese attempts to build the One Belt, One Road infrastructure that they want to do. And ultimately, the Russians decided that they were going to fight in Syria because they didn't want to have to fight inside the Russia itself. So their deployment is entirely defensive. But as an entirely defensive deployment, they're not going to back down. Why would they?
As Vanessa talked there about false flags in Syria, there are a lot of people pushing for this kind of thing. And one of them is a chap called Patrick Clawson. He's part of the, he's one of the employed in a US Israeli think tank, a part of the Israel lobby. And he is suggesting that maybe a false flag would be a good idea to start a war with Iran. So let's have a listen to him now.
I frankly think that crisis initiation is really tough. And it's very hard for me to see how the United States president can get us to war with Iran. Which leads me to conclude that if, in fact, compromise is not coming, that the traditional way of America gets to war is what would be best for U.S. interests. Some people might think that Mr. Roosevelt wanted to get us into World War II, as David mentioned. You may recall we had to wait for Pearl Harbor. Some people might think Mr. Wilson wanted to get us into World War I. You may recall he had to wait for the Lusitania episode. Some people might think that Mr. Johnson wanted to send troops to Vietnam. You may recall they had to wait for the Gulf of Tonkin episode. We didn't go to war with Spain until the USS, until the Maine exploded. And may I point out that Mr. Lincoln did not feel he could call out the Federal Army until Fort Sumter was attacked, which is why he ordered the commander at Fort Sumter to do exactly that thing which the South Carolinians had said would cause an attack. So if, in fact, the Iranians aren't going to compromise, it would be best if somebody else started the war. One can combine other means of pressure with sanctions. I mentioned that explosion on August 17th. We could step up the pressure. I mean, look, people, Iranian submarines periodically go down. Someday one of them might not come up. Who would know why? We can do a variety of things if we wish to increase the pressure. I'm not advocating that. But I'm just suggesting that this is not a either-or proposition. Of, you know, it's just sanctions has to succeed or other things. We are in the game of using covert means against the Iranians. We could get nastier at that.
Well, you know, when they're talking amongst themselves, they speak the truth. They are in the game of using covert means against the Iranians. Well, it couldn't be clearer, could it? They want a war, they're looking for a war, they're looking to provoke a war.
What about
when they get one, they might not like it.
What about the list he gave there? Pearl Harbor, the sinking of the Lusitania, the Gulf of Tonkin, the sinking of the ship the Maine, and also Fort Sumter in the American Civil War.
All right, well, I mean, it's hard to bracket all. All of them were casus belli, if you like, but let's just pick on one, the Gulf of Tonkin incident. All the evidence suggests that it was a fabricated incident, fabricated by the US in order to create a casus belli against North Vietnam.
What about Pearl Harbor?
Pearl Harbor, there's a long, big literature about that, and it's quite clear that the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor because they felt they had no option, because Roosevelt had cut them off from oil supplies and so on, and he needed them to attack Pearl Harbor so that he could then have a war against Germany, as it turned out to be.
I mean, the Americans pretended, didn't they? That, yeah. They didn't know that the ship...
They cracked the Japanese naval codes, and they knew what they were going to do.
And but in any case, what about the Lusitania?
Well, the Lusitania was actually carrying war materiel across the Atlantic to help the Allies against the Germans. And the Germans were foolish to sink it, but they did, because they knew it was actually carrying war materiel. Now, in actual fact, each of those incidents is actually separate, so you can't just put them all in together. But I think mentioning both the Gulf of Tonkin, I think that is the incident. The Gulf of Tonkin incident never took place. It was a bit like the Douma chemical weapons attack. Nothing happened. It was actually leveraged into, oh my goodness me, the North Koreans have attacked us with a speedboat. And on that basis, the United States went to war with North Vietnam. But of course, what I'd like to remind them is they lost. So you can start wars, but you can't necessarily finish them. If they go to war with Iran, they're going to lose their whole navy in the Gulf in the first half hour. That's what's going to happen. They're going to lose. They're fools.
Okay, now let's mention briefly the Zadists over in France taking on everything President Macron stands for. So we've got 7,000 people joining the squatters near Nantes in western France to defend their buildings from 2,500 riot police. Now, this is a vast area of land, many acres in France, and it's basically a kind of permaculture community, mostly lefties, who are living there and actually building things, Martin, growing food, all that sort of thing. Apparently, it's government land, and the authorities have decided that the whole thing has got to be bulldozed.
Well, this is the first I've heard of this, so I'll be interested to hear what comes of it. I mean, in France, there's a great tradition of contestation where people, you know, resist the state. You know, farmers turn up and tip all of their vegetables all over the local town hall. Protesters protest. It's a great French tradition, and long may it continue.
This latest reports on this whole confrontation are from around about a week ago or so. The muddy and bloody battle in the fields of western France. This is in the local France paper. Tear gas, petrol bombs, as French police clear what they call it an eco camp, and that's the Guardian on the 10th of April. But Martin, this is the sort of confrontation that you kind of was almost inevitable with the Macron government. They don't really seem to be all that. They're apparently anti-airport protesters, many of them, a bit like the camp that was there called Grow Heathrow.
Yeah, or the people who protested against Narita Airport in Tokyo. Now, I don't know.
But much bigger scale. We're talking about 5,000 people.
It's all right. Well, I mean, this is the first I've heard of it, so I don't really know the ins and outs of it. But the fact of the matter is Macron is not popular. He only got elected because the left voted for him to keep out Marine Le Pen. And they didn't vote for him, they voted against her. So his actual level of support is actually quite
weak. He came out of nowhere, didn't he? Actually, he's a former Rothschild bank employee.
Indeed. Basically, he rescued France from Marine Le Pen, but he was only able to do that because the left voted for him to keep her out, because he was in the second round. He was the one that made it to the second round. But of course, in actual fact, the left in France despise Macron, and ultimately the left will win, I think, in France, because historically they always have, and Macron will go the way of other puppets before him.
But he's there for another few years still, isn't he?
He is, but I don't think he's attacking these people and having a confrontation with them is not going to do him any good at all.
Another thing which rather worries me about the way France is going is he's trying now to seize the bank accounts of all the mosques in France. Now, this might sound like take government control over the bank accounts of the mosques. Now, this has echoes of what Hitler was doing in the early 30s to the Jewish community, which was beginning to seize control of their finances.
Well, the other thing, of course, is that it was shown with Mohammed bin Salman, the dictator of Saudi Arabia, was shown with his arm round Macron. And Macron's a great fan of Saudi Arabia, who in actual fact are the big funders of jihadi propaganda, both in France and Britain. The obvious thing to do is stop the Saudis funding mosques. Don't bother to close down all the mosques, just stop the Saudis spending any money on mosques, because they're a dictatorship, and they use that money to try and bend simple minds in their direction.
It might sound like a stupid question, but why doesn't Macron simply do that?
Because in actual fact, this is a means of social control over people who disagree with his policy. If they were serious about crushing jihadi terrorism, they would basically, we shouldn't have gone to war with Afghanistan, we should have gone to war with Saudi Arabia. But far from going to war with Saudi Arabia, we actually support Saudi Arabia. And as we've been hearing in the early part of the programme, the White Helmets and all these other organisations embedded with Al-Qaeda, we train those people. The SAS are training jihadi Al-Qaeda terrorists as we speak. And of course in Yemen, the Saudis are bombing and killing, creating the biggest humanitarian catastrophe on the planet, according to the UN, including a major cholera outbreak. British military personnel are helping them do that.
Okay.
I think it's time for a war, don't you, Tony? Time for a real war.
No, I don't think so. No, I don't.
No, I'm just mocking their stupid rhetoric. They claim to want war, and ultimately, the only thing that stops dogs that bark at buses is when they catch one.
Now let's talk about Anna Politkovskaya, because I was rather concerned to see a lot of talk about Putin killed this journalist. So looking a little bit deeper into her story, she died around about October 2006. Well, she didn't die. She was shot dead in her tower block as she was in one of the lifts by a guy in a baseball cap. And it was seemed to be some kind of contract killing. Now, is that the sort of thing that Putin might have done? Because she was writing some very articles very critical of Putin back then, Martin.
Well, I have to tell you, I used to go to Russia in the 1990s, and lots of people were being killed, particularly journalists, anybody who got any information. You could tread on somebody's toes just like that. And at one stage in Kiev, for example, it cost about $400 to get somebody killed. That's not always necessarily the state. Well, and I had a run-in with those kind of people when I was over there.
She was killed on Putin's birthday, apparently. And she was the journalist.
Oh, well, he must be guilty then.
She was the journalist who published three different articles on how someone was testing polonium on Chechen children. So where have we seen that scenario before, says an article I was reading about, remember Anna Politkovskaya. So Anna's lawyer, Stanislav Markelov, was also murdered in 2009, followed by the murder of one of the key informants of the in Chechnya, Natalie Estonirova, the same year. So there's been a whole load of other murders after this. Actually, there were a lot of prosecutions as well, which we haven't really heard about, and they were of FSB agents who'd been following her in Moscow and following her down in Chechnya, and it turned out that they'd been taking money from the Chechen mafia.
Well, in actual fact, if you think about the murder of Boris Nemtsov, the Moscow police did a fantastic job of catching everybody involved with that, and they were all sent to prison. But of course, we're told that Russia is a lawless state. It was a lawless state. It still is to some extent, but not nearly as lawless as the United States of America or Britain.
The killers, it seems, were actually possibly being possibly paid by Boris Berezovsky. Would that make any sense?
Well, that would, because Berezovsky got Samuel Basiev to invade Dagestan as part of his strategy to prevent the communists winning the 1998 election.
Anyway, I'll put some links up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 8 o'clock. Thanks to our guests, Tim Bowles and Eleanor Cumley. He's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.